Well, hello, everyone. I'm James Dobson, and you're listening to Family Talk, a listener-supported ministry. In fact, thank you so much for being part of that support for James Dobson Family Institute.
Well, hello again, and welcome to another week of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. We are so glad that you've joined us today. I'm Roger Marsh, and I want to ask you a question. Do you and your spouse have a young one, or maybe a couple, running around the house right now? I bet you have your hands full if that's your situation. And, well, welcome to toddlerhood. On today's and tomorrow's broadcast, we are going to present a classic conversation that Dr. Dobson had with an esteemed panel of pediatricians, dispensing practical advice for those in the midst of that most critical time of parenthood. Dr. Dobson's guests are Dr. Paul Reiser, Dr. Bob Mann, and Dr. Marianne Nelson. Dr. Paul Reiser is a retired family practitioner. He served as lead author of The Complete Guide to Family Health, Nutrition, and Fitness, and the bestseller Complete Guide to Baby and Child Care. Dr. Bob Mann currently serves as the senior physician at Cook's Children's Hospital in Mansfield, Texas. He is the founding board member of Mission Arlington Mission Metroplex, where a medical clinic was named in his honor. And Dr. Marianne Nelson is a family medicine specialist based in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Dr. Nelson is affiliated with Mercy Medical Center and St. Luke's Hospital. Well, we have a lot of material to cover, so let's go there right now. Here now is Dr. Dobson to introduce today's program.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about with these folks. The first series of broadcasts that we did on the book dealt with babies primarily, getting youngsters safely through infancy. And we're going to start with the one-year-old now and move up the age scale from there. Paul, before we do that, I just talked to Bob about writing this book and what a task it was. You bore the primary responsibility.
That's right.
How in the world did you find time to do this?
Well, as I mentioned on the prior broadcast, it was more an exercise in sleep deprivation after a while. And it was also about 3 years of always being behind. And it was, I must confess, we had a lot of hours and days when I began to wonder if I could really keep going into the night to do some of these things.
Because this was done after
hours,
weekends?
We had full practice going. And then so after that, come home, sit down at the word processor, start writing, and weekends. And I took the laptop everywhere. The laptop went on every car ride that was more than an hour, and on every trip, and on every airplane ride. And I did a lot of making up time. I sat in one LAX at a McDonald's one day waiting for a plane with my thing plugged in, typing away. And God just was really good to us as a group, and me in particular, especially on some nights when it was getting late and there was no tomorrow. And sometimes I just said, Lord, what do you want this book to say? And I think in some cases, and I'd like to think in a lot of it, he said the following, and out it came.
You know, I've been there, and every author has, where you have a deadline and you're plugging away trying to get your thoughts down. But what made your job tougher is what's called group writing.
Right.
I don't know anything harder than group writing, because it's so aesthetic and it's somebody's judgment of the way things ought to be said. And you've got 11 physicians who are used to making their own decisions working together. How in the world did you pull that off?
You know, I think we had an example of God's leadership in a group of people who were just willing to give and take. It was hard for me to have a lot of stuff that I had written get picked apart line by line. And believe me, these folks did. I mean, it was inch by inch. And we would often get into great debates and discussions about certain aspects. Sometimes we come back to the same chapter 10 or 12 times to get it right and to get more input.
I got in on some of those debates,
we sometimes decided we would, appeal to Caesar here to get some, get a final verdict. But there was an interesting way God brought everybody together into the same room. We had just different things we brought in, and we came away from that experience tighter, bonded together, more, I think, unified than on anything we've ever done. And it was a wonderful experience.
Someone said the other day it was really the body together. All the different parts of the body were there. We all brought different things to the table, had different gifts, but God used each one of them.
Molded it into what is now an 850-page book. Marianne, what was it like for you?
Well, we would also try to help Paul by doing some of the writing, and we would do that, but found out that each of us had very much a different flavor of writing, and it did take Paul's pen to smooth things over and turn it into the delightful flow that is part of the book, and that's part of
Paul. Are you all proud of this now?
We are all very proud of this book.
I think that this is going to be a blessing to parents for many years to come. Let's talk about the content. One-year-olds. Let's start with, Paul, what you call the Declaration of Independence. What do you mean by that?
Well, the one-year-old is a wonderful creature in that he or she has been spending a lot of hours, a lot of months, starting around 7 or 8 months, exploring the world and finding out about everything, how it tastes, how it feels, what happens when you drop it, what happens when you throw it, sometimes looking at the same thing over and over, even when you ask him not to, when he can crawl. And yet it's an exploratory effort. But around 14, 16 months, something begins to change. And the question that this now baby on wheels is asking you is, who's in charge here? If you said to do that or not to do that and I do it, what's going to happen around here? How much power do I have? How much can I influence this world around me in perhaps opposition to other people that want me to do something? And so there is this what is called oppositional stage. Actually, it's often said to be part of the twos, but it really starts by about 18 months, and it's very important to get a handle on it as a parent.
It's like something throws a switch. It is amazing when that occurs. In fact, I think one of the most dramatic facts of child development for me is that a 6 or 7 or 8 pound baby comes into the world absolutely and totally helpless, cannot hold a bottle, can't roll over, can't ask for anything except by screaming, and is totally dependent in every way. And 18 months later, this, you know, 18, 20, 22-pound child looks a 200-pound man in the face and says, where do you get off telling me what to do? That transformation that takes place is just incredible.
I love to call this the Velcro age. At age one, they cling to the parents or a familiar adult tightly, but yet at the same time like to break free to explore their universe and do all the things that Paul has just talked to us about. It becomes a very trying time during examinations in the office because parents are appalled by this child who came in for well baby checks prior to 1 month of age and were very compliant and relatively easily to examine. And now from age 1 to 2, there is terror and screaming and fright by this person. And each parent just can't quite understand that this is a very normal stage of development. But I really like to instill in the parents that this is very normal. It's how thankful we can be that there is that Velcro attachment from child to parent at that age when their speed is so fast and they are so fearless and don't know gravity. How good it is that they have that clinging to the familiar parent.
We refer to this as the first adolescence because the same kind of question of independence is going to happen again between about 12 and 20. Except there, your job is to get that young adult independent. Mm-hmm. And at this time, your job is to say, I love you, I care about you, I'll do anything for you, except I'm in charge and you're not.
Yeah, and it's very important to get across that message. Bob, one of the other things that parents worry about at this time is that the child stops eating as much and they are afraid that they're not going to get enough nutrition for good health. What do you say to them?
I say, don't worry about it. My own son went on strike for nearly 5 months. He ate breakfast, and the rest of the day he just picked. And that's very important at that particular stage that, one, the parents not worry. Secondly, that grandparents don't come on the scene and worry about the baby's eating and start letting them snack and letting them graze all day long because babies can develop very bad eating habits. They're not growing rapidly then, and they just don't have the needs.
The standard growth charts, which are included in the appendix of this book and a part of every well baby exam, are tremendously helpful for parents to see because they literally can see by the slope of the graph that the rate of change of height and weight slows down dramatically at the age of one.
And therefore, they need fewer calories.
That's right.
And then you're in the middle of this oppositional business, and you think you're going to make this one-year-old eat every last kernel of corn on the plate or whatever you're serving them, or mashed potatoes or whatever. And they don't want to do it. And this is the wrong fight, really. You put the food out, and they'll pick out, as long as it's good stuff, let them figure out what they want to eat. Don't turn it into a big brawl every time you have a meal.
That's a battle a child can win, isn't it?
Yeah, they will win it. They will win that battle every single time. Except the only thing is, as Bob was saying, you can turn into a food hostage where they will only eat this or that, and then the parent thinks, I better give him macaroni and cheese every meal or else he won't grow. And that's a big mistake.
Now, how about vision and hearing at that stage? Can you do accurate measures of vision at that age?
Not in a standard office setting. It's very difficult to do. It's more observation than it is testing.
Can you tell if there's a serious visual problem?
Most of the time you can.
Mostly what you worry about more is hearing, though, because these kids are sometimes getting ear infections. They're getting some material piling up in the middle ear as a result of that. And you start to wonder if the gobbledygook coming out when they speak is really something that reflects adequately what they're hearing, or are they losing some hearing because of those infections?
And how do you tell if a child has a hearing problem?
One way would be by observing what sounds are coming from them. Generally speaking, by the age of one, a child should be able to say one or two words that would be intelligible to the listeners, but generally be able to understand everything that's going on around them. Another way that you could tell a child is having a hearing problem is if they seem to be uttering sounds that can be felt by them. If there were guttural sounds, as we would say, or sounds that could be felt in the throat, those types of observations might be consistent with a child with a hearing loss. There are ways of doing hearing exams without a child's cooperation, and in fact, even when a child sleeps. So there are ways of technically checking it at any age.
Do you recommend that parents cling a glass behind them, a ding, 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 behind the child to see if he or she turns?
I would say that, generally speaking, if there is a hearing problem, parents will have observed
it
just by surroundings. The other thing, as you mentioned, about how would you know if your child had a visual problem, one of the most common things would be if a child's eyes seem to be crossed consistently or when they are very tired. That often is a clue that there is a visual problem. I might also mention about hearing that many times in hospital settings during the newborn period, hearing evaluations are done as a matter of routine.
During the newborn period?
Yes.
How do they do that?
They do that by something called brainstem auditory evoked response. Help me, friends. Is that right? Okay. And that is done in our newborn nurseries. The other thing would be in terms of visual checking, high-risk children, children who have spent time in neonatal intensive care units, would have ophthalmologic evaluation prior to discharge to make sure that the vision is indeed not been affected.
All right. Now, that period that we're talking about, 15 to 20 months or so, maybe a little beyond, is very important to the development of language skills. How can a parent contribute to the formations of language at that time?
Lots of ways. Mm-hmm. And the most important is to talk with that child and use very appropriate language. I always caution parents, it's fun to do baby talk and change all your language around and goo goo da da and all that, but the child needs to hear from you the king's or queen's English. Mm-hmm. And you can engage that child in all kinds of activities that allow you to do that. You can talk about what you're doing while you're folding clothes or you're cleaning up something, and you just talk about it. What's going on here? And also something that we just talk about over and over, it's rarely too early, 18 months or beyond, to sit down with a little picture book and begin to start talking through images and some of the words by two. Some kids really are fascinated by books, and we just encourage parents to get them to build that fascination.
How about toys? What toys do you recommend for that age group?
Soft toys, safe toys, toys that don't have parts that can come off and be inhaled. One of the biggest concerns would be young children inhaling small parts of toys that can get clog their airway.
Yeah, this is not the good age for Legos. Little kids this age love balls. They love little balls that'll bounce around. And one toy that's kind of fun is about an 8 to 12-inch inflatable ball. Can't do too much damage. They can't inhale it. They love to watch it bounce around. You know, it can't knock over the lamp. And if they blow it up or lose it, then just get another one.
Everything goes to the mouth.
Everything.
At that age.
Expensive toys are not the object either. Sometimes there would be great fascination by a lid from a plastic container from the kitchen, or just any various safe, soft objects from the kitchen Those are great.
Educational toys also are not that important.
Right.
The simple things, as Marianne was saying, are just as helpful as the expensive.
You get them the big fancy educational training set. You know, going to teach them the ABCs by the time they're two, and they play with a box. Yeah. Forget the rest of stuff.
Or pots and pans and a spoon to beat
right.
on them.
Yeah, you know, that's so they don't care. It really is. It's just the tactile sensations of it.
There are toys now, though. I'm a stage removed from what they're selling to kids this age, because our children are long beyond that. But I saw the other day on a stroller a little device that the child could punch, and it played different musical sounds. And this little kid, less than 2 years of age, was just punching one button right after another, and obviously swinging with the music. You know, sure.
Two should be playing on a computer too. So.
You should not get in a panic about trying to teach advanced learning concepts, reading for preschoolers and so on. It comes naturally for some, but you shouldn't make a pressurized thing out
absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, as nice as some programs like Sesame Street are, some little kids and older age groups, two or three especially, get into that. I always advise parents, don't rely on Bert and Ernie to do this job. It really happens in the home. And as long as there are people there talking to that child.
Let's talk about sleeping. How much time, how many hours per night should toddlers be sleeping?
Probably they average 11 to 13 with a couple of naps during the day. Bedtimes vary greatly, sleep habits vary greatly, but it's reasonable to have a routine at night to put the child down at the same time every night with the same slowdown period. At least that gives the parents the time to themselves.
And you do feel napping is important?
We do feel napping is important, usually two at this age.
Even if the child screams bloody murder and doesn't want to be put down.
It is still important to have the child go down. At least that gives the parents a moment to themselves.
But like with many other things, you just have to agree that one size doesn't fit all. And you can't say, because most kids need two naps. Some at 18 months may do very fine on one nap. It's the total hours of sleep in a 24-hour period that are probably more important than exactly the schedule.
And those total hours should be, as Marianne said,
about 16 hours, probably a 24-hour period.
Huh. Unfortunately, bedtime is often the great battle zone of this age, because, man, it's not their idea. They don't want to go down. Everybody else is up. You know, things are happening. And there's a little separation anxiety. And, hey, I don't want to do this. And an older child, especially, who's getting to the point where they can get out of their crib, can be a real problem. They're in and out of bed, not wanting to go down. And some parents make the mistake of thinking, well, I'll just let him wind down by himself. And so they have this toddler wandering around the house till 9 or 10, crankier, more irritable. Nobody's getting any quiet time. And we really believe strongly in getting those kids to bed early, because you need time with the older kids if you have any. And if you don't, you need time by yourself or with your spouse without some cranky toddler in the room.
Okay, let's get real practical. You've got this 20-month-old, 22, 24-month-old, who's standing in a crib screaming bloody murder. And he is really upset because he doesn't want to be in there. And you're determined that he's going to stay there. What happens?
Well, hopefully you've still got a crib that's got a sidebar high enough to keep them in place. If it's getting less than about 3/4 of their body height, look out, because they might be able
tumble
to
tumble out, sure,
hit the floor. But the other thing is to make sure, Marianne mentioned this, bedtime. Get this whole ritual down to where it's really a fun time. It can be a wonderful time with a child, especially when they're older, but even at this age, so that they're not, you don't want to just have this big wild chase around the house and say, okay, time for bed. Yeah. They need to be kind of eased into it. And then once you're done with it, then that's it. And if you decide to come back to say something about all the screaming and yelling, it should be very short, very businesslike. No more snacks, no more fun, no more party, just we're going to bed.
Not every child is going to be the same. We have a grandchild who at 18 months, you read to her, and she just dives into her crib. I mean, she just snuggles around her stuffed animals. There's no battle at all. Never has been a battle. So it's not
the difference between the compliant child and the strong-willed child.
Going back to what Paul said about the child falling out of the crib, the first time that happened, we would always lower the side of the crib and just go ahead and allow the child to climb out so that they wouldn't injure themselves. It was an interesting transition. We realized that we had reached a major point in the child's life. And it made it a lot easier for us to sleep at night knowing they weren't going to fall out. They were just going to climb out of the crib.
And then what do you do with a child who won't stay in there?
Well,
and then you got another problem.
Yeah. Right.
What do you all consider to be the most important emotional need that a child in the toddler years has? What would you put at the top of the list?
Security, love and security, and knowing that they're loved, and knowing they're not going to be left behind, knowing that their needs are going to be met.
Can a two-year-old tell that?
Oh, yeah.
They can tell it a lot younger than that. One thing we encourage parents to think about is in the midst of this tearing around with this small baby on wheels, it's into everything and all over the house, sometimes parents are just in survival mode at this point. All they can think of is, how am I going to get through this day? How am I going to get this place cleaned up? How am I going to keep some order? And we remind them that this baby that's now running around is no less fearfully and wonderfully made than the newborn. To get fascinated by what they're doing, to just become an observer, to step back a little bit and just marvel at what's going on, rather than just thinking, oh no, there's another mess to pick up.
All right, now I want to make sure that parents understand what we're saying here. Obviously, when you leave a toddler at church or with a babysitter or with someone else, and you do need to get away from that child. You can't mother 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are times when you have to get away. That youngster is going to feel insecure and is going to cry and cling and throw a temper tantrum perhaps, or do everything that he or she can to tell you they're unhappy about this and threaten by it. In our desire to give security to that child and assure them of our love, you're not suggesting that we avoid those kinds of momentary separations.
Not at all. That's something that's important for the parent and for the child. They need to know that you are going to come back after a little while when you leave them. And if they're with you every single second of the day, you're going to have problems eventually if they don't learn about how to do that.
A child also needs to know before the event that this is going to happen. It's a mistake to just be gone and disappear without the child having some type of a forewarning that this brief absence of the parent is going to occur.
And a little preconditioning helps too. And obviously, if the absence is going to be with grandma and grandpa that spoil them rotten and they have a great time, hey, they're over there and say, see you later, mom.
Yeah.
But if it's maybe somebody new, a sitter, it's not a bad idea to let that person, whom you've already pre-screened, needless to say, and you feel comfortable with, let them come over and spend some time around the house with you, with the baby, so that they become kind of like part of the furniture. And it isn't quite such a big jolt then to leave.
Paul, you and I both acknowledged a minute ago the struggles, the exhaustion that comes with rearing a toddler. And you can just get worn out at it. And I'm convinced that some child abuse grows out of that point of exhaustion where maybe a young mother, she's 19, 20 years of age, and she hadn't even had a chance to be a kid herself yet, all the way through adulthood. And this youngster is just giving her a hard time, can abuse a child, do things that she never believed she would be able to do. How do we avoid toddler burnout, for want of a better word?
You could do a whole program just on that subject, but a couple of things that we think are important. One is, as you mentioned, getting a little time away. The primary caregiver needs a little time out. They need to go do something, especially if it's a mom at home who's there all day. They need to schedule some time. Go to the park. Go to the mall. Get out with a friend. Have some coffee. Also, there's a big problem with adult conversation. If a woman is listening to toddlers all day long, she is dying for some adults to talk to at the end of the day. And it's very important for her husband. If he's the one outside coming in at the end of the workday, not to just fling his briefcase on the chair, sit down in front of the TV, and not start to help her deal with these kids and talk to her. I'm a big believer in the married couple making sure that they continue to cement that relationship for the child's sake, let alone their own, and to spend time talking with each other at the end of the day, especially when things are starting to get kind of frazzled.
Roger Marsh here, jumping in to let you know that Well, we're up against the clock, and we've run out of time for today's broadcast. But we're going to stop right here as our guests begin discussing parental burnout. That's exactly where we will pick up on tomorrow's program with Dr. Dobson and his guests, pediatricians Dr. Paul Reiser, Dr. Bob Mann, and Dr. Marianne Nelson. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, if you missed any part of today's broadcast, or if you want to check out today and tomorrow to catch the complete interview, just go to drjamesdobson.org/Family Talk. And one final announcement. If you haven't done so already, I hope you'll join us during the month of July and take the 30-Day Kindness Challenge. It's being presented in partnership with our ministry friend, Shanti Feldhahn. 30 days of encouragement to improve any relationship with an email to your inbox every morning. Just go to drjamesdobson.org/kindnesschallenge. Well, I hope you go out and are especially kind to someone today. God's richest blessings to you and your family. And be sure to join us again tomorrow for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
This has been a presentation of the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute.
Hi, everyone. Dr. Tim Clinton here for Family Talk. Are you on the go without much time to log in to all your social media pages? Twitter's a great way for staying informed on the things that matter most to you with just a quick look on your phone. Follow Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. Receive great tips, resources, information, inspiration that's important to you in short, simple tweets. Again, that's Dr. James Dobson, capital F, capital T, on Twitter.